Hi, Dan.
Hello, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm doing all right. We are here to discuss, and I always have the books of other people when we talk about them, your just-released book, The Moral Animal, which I am holding up in front of the camera.
Actually, it's not called The Moral Animal.
No, I'm sorry. Oh, God.
I thought just for branding purposes, Dan, I would not use the same title that I used for previous books.
You see,
it's just a brand differentiation thing.
Shouldn't you have called it The Moral Animal, too? I mean, why is it that, you know, in movies you can just, you know, slap a 2 on something and everyone knows what it is, but you can't do that with books?
Actually, non-zero 2 would be more appropriate. It tracks on the argument in that book a little more than The Moral Animal, although they're not unrelated. But
so, I'm sorry, The Evolution of God.
Yeah. Yeah, but any excuse to keep talking about the title is good. So that was a good little segment there.
Yes, you like it how I strategically screwed that up.
It's all good.
But anyway, I believe you've already talked a little bit about the book with Tyler Cowen on a previous Blogging Heads. I think this time around we're supposed to be discussing the international relations implications of the book. But for those of you, those poor, pitiable few of you in the audience that have not reached, you know, rushed out and bought the book and devoured all of its contents, perhaps you could give a quick précis of what your argument is, particularly with regard to international relations.
And first of all, I apologize to people who are getting a little sick of this. This is the second dialogue I've done, and at some point I'll start feeling guilty about using Blogging Heads to talk about the book. But we're not there yet. Okay, so in terms of relevance to kind of contemporary politics and international affairs, I guess, you know, one point of the book is to try to figure out how you bring out the best in religion, what circumstances bring out the best and the worst. And although the question's ultimately about the contemporary world, I looked at it largely by reference to the ancient world, because I tell the story of the development of God, and especially the Abrahamic God. Most of the book is, you know, emergence of monotheism in Israel, ancient Israel, emergence of Christianity, emergence of Islam. And one theme I focus on, not the only one in that span, is kind of the mood fluctuations of God, you know, so that, you know, in the Quran, one minute God is, speaking through Muhammad, is advising Muslims to say to unbelievers, you've got your religion, we've got ours, can't we get along? Another moment, he's advising them to kill unbelievers. In the Bible, at one point, God is telling the Israelites to annihilate nearby peoples who worship foreign gods. At another point, you have the Israelites not only suggesting peaceful coexistence with a neighbor that worships a foreign god, but actually invoking that foreign god to validate the coexistence. So they say, you know, you've got your god Chemosh, we've got our god Yahweh. Your god gave you your land, our god gave us ours, can't we get along? So what I wanted to do was try to the extent that you can discern the circumstances that surrounded the writing of these scriptures,
right,
or the uttering of them in Muhammad's case, try to figure out what circumstances incline the authors of scripture to interpret God's will as belligerent in one case and tolerant in another. I came up with an argument that probably won't surprise you, basically, I mean, I kind of dress it up in game theoretical language. You don't quite have to. I say that when a religious group views another group of people as potentially, you know, collaborating to their benefit, you know, potentially in a win-win, non-zero-sum situation, they are more likely, or if they even view peaceful coexistence to be in their interest relative to the alternative, they are more likely to find in their own religion a basis for tolerating the religion of the other people, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas to the extent that they view the relationship as zero-sum, they, in particular, if they see the other people as some kind of threat to their material interests, to their values, or feel kind of massively disrespected, which is kind of a, psychologically speaking, is a kind of a proxy for, you know, kind of symbolizes a zero-sum relationship,
mm-hmm.
Then they're more likely to find belligerence in their religion. The one exception to that, I would say, is they might perceive the relationship to be zero-sum, but be sure that they're going to lose, they're going to be on the losing end of the competition.
Right.
In which case, And you see this, I think, in both the Quran and the Bible in situations like this. In fact, I would say that actually accounts for those two tolerant scriptures I just recounted from both traditions. Those seem to be, I'm trying to remember, if that's a Meccan surah in the case of Muhammad, it probably is a case of just feeling massively outnumbered. And the standard scholarly interpretation of that verse from the Bible where they're saying, can't we get along, is that the Israelites were afraid they were going to get killed by the Ammonites and had a setback recently.
Which has generally been a common, I mean, you know, this was my thought, because at least from the Old Testament, which is the one I'm most familiar with, the Israelites tend to be outnumbered most of the time.
Yes, they do. And in general, I mean, an argument I make is that an increasingly zero-sum perspective, I argue that monotheism emerged later than some people think,
right,
not until the Babylonian exile of the 6th century BCE. And I argue that there's evidence of times when in Israel there's tremendous tolerance of foreign gods and even worship of them by kings like Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually, as I would predict, it seems to reflect a non-zero-sum view of the world. You know, what the Bible blames Solomon's worshiping all these gods on his having all these foreign wives. But, Dan, as you would know, as a student of ancient geopolitics, that's probably not the actual connection between the wives and the gods. I mean, in ancient times, if a king had a lot of foreign wives, it was an expression of an internationalist foreign policy. He wanted to consolidate ties with all these nations because
right.
he saw something to gain from interaction with them,
mm-hmm.
saw it as non-zero-sum. And that would be the same reason he was paying respect to their gods, maybe even building altars to them. So it's like his politics led to the wives and the gods. It's not the
right,
wives that led to the gods.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree.
So I argue that then what moves Israel in the direction of monotheism, at least initially, is an increasingly nationalist air that's grounded in a possibly accurate perception of relations with neighbors as zero-sum. You know, Israel lives in a bad neighborhood, small country, a lot of conflict, often doesn't win. And then when its leaders do deals with foreign, with the great powers like Assyria or Egypt, they tend to be on subordinate terms. Israel is a vassal state.
Yeah.
And people seem to find that humiliating. And I try to show that you actually find this perception in the earliest prophetic texts that are insisting on exclusive devotion to Yahweh. Hosea is, by standard dating, the earliest prophetic text that insists on that. And I argue there's a very nationalist air. You know, he's very against Israel's getting involved in foreign entanglements and is specifically not happy about the kinds of deals they've gotten from great powers.
So in other words, your argument is that when monotheism really comes to the fore within Judaism, it does so from an isolationist position, which is by embracing monotheism, the Israelites will simultaneously have a more cohesive state, but they would also engage in a policy of withdrawal from most of the rest of great power politics in the Middle East.
Well, I doubt there were any kings who were entirely isolationist in their policy.
But, no, you couldn't afford to be completely isolationist.
You couldn't be completely.
But you understand what I'm saying.
Right. It is the... absolutely, it's an isolationist impulse that you see in the prophets who are denouncing the worship of foreign gods, which makes sense in terms of the geopolitics of the time. And that's not enough to get Israel all the way to monotheism. And in fact, Hosea probably wasn't a monotheist. He was probably what scholars call a monolatrist, which is to say he's insisting on exclusive devotion to one god without denying that the other gods exist.
Right.
But still, this impulse moves, I think, Israel a ways down the road toward monotheism.
Okay. I mean, the one question I had in reading the parts of the book, which I truly did enjoy, was the relationship between, I think, monotheism and proselytizing. And to what extent was religion considered, or conversion considered, a tool of foreign policy? Because the thing that, correct me if I'm wrong, you could argue there is a loose correlation over time that later incantations or later evocations of monotheistic religions are more proselytizing religions. The Jewish, you know, Judaism on the whole is not a proselytizing religion. Tradition now is that if you want to convert to Judaism, rabbis try to persuade you against that fact. Christianity and Catholicism is certainly willing to do this. More later versions of Protestantism are much more evangelical, much more proselytizing. And of course, Islam is quite, the proselytizing religion. You know, do you think this? To what extent did national leaders see their, you know, their monotheism as not just a source of national power, but also a source of influencing foreign powers?
Let me just say, first of all, I'm not sure in the modern world how proselytizing Islam is. I've been approached by a lot of Americans who want to convert me to their religion, and although there are six or seven Muslims in America, none of them have been Muslims. I'm told that actually in Africa, where Christianity interfaces with Muslims, it's much more American Christian missionaries go and try to convert the Muslims, and the Muslims aren't especially working hard to convert Christians. But anyway, certainly it was a doctrine of early Islamic foreign policy that the point of conquest was. Now, interestingly, once they did the conquering, they kind of changed their minds, and that's an illustration to me of how responsive religious doctrine is to facts on the ground. Once Islam had an empire to run, they decided, look, forced conversion is a lose-lose game here. I mean, it's a lot easier to let Christians and Jews worship and later let Zoroastrians, let polytheists even, and maybe charge them a higher tax, but, like, you know, live and let live.
Yeah.
So I think Christianity just leads the league in proselytizing in a certain sense. But so you're asking about is monotheism when deployed as an instrument of foreign policy is conversion very often part of the game plan?
Yeah.
Is that? It's a good question. When it emerged in ancient Israel, I would say that was very much the idea. When you see it emerge, is I think in the exile, the earliest prophetic text that's unequivocally monotheistic is so-called Second Isaiah. And what's happening there is Israel's been humiliated, and the elites are in Babylon trying to figure out what happened, and they start envisioning this day, the coming apocalypse, when their fortunes will be reversed, their persecutors will be subjugated, and there the idea is very explicit that, and I think this gives rise to a monotheism that is temporarily of a particularly belligerent sort, which is the idea is, all of our oppressors will not only acknowledge that they have been defeated in this coming day, and not only acknowledge the superiority of our gods, which would be a standard interpretation of losing a war in the ancient Middle East, but they will find out that their gods don't even exist. That's how thoroughgoing our vindication is going to be. So I think at its inception, the idea of monotheism is in this symbolic way, yes, consistent with what you're talking about. On the other hand, I argue that immediately after the exile, when Israel finally is in a secure neighborhood because its neighbors are fellow members of the Persian Empire, and a zero-sum view of the world no longer makes sense, I argue you actually get a much more benign and inclusive form of monotheism that isn't out to convert neighbors and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have a different period of history in mind, probably, right, when you ask that question?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of sort of, Judaism much later. But also, I mean, I think to some extent what comes to mind is the sort of different evolutions of Christianity or different denominations of Christianity, which is each latter, you know, as you move forward, you know, and I'm treading on dangerous ground here because it's not my area of expertise, but, you know, from a surface sketch, it strikes me that, you know, later invocations of Christianity, first Protestantism, you know, one could argue Mormonism at this point, are ever more proselytizing than the previous versions of it. And then from an IR perspective, I take your point about, you know, modern Islam not necessarily being as proselytizing, but proselytizing religions can be seen as a threat. There's concern within Latin America, for example, between the Catholic Church and sort of growing evangelism down there. One of the questions I had reading your book was to what extent do monotheists deal with other monotheists, you know, being proselytizers?
It's a good question. I don't know that there's a universal answer, and I honestly don't know that much about the history after the early establishment of the Islamic Empire.
Yeah.
I mean, my story kind of stops there for the most part, and then I jump to modern day implications. And I think, you know, there's huge, I don't know, I mean, what would you say about the Crusades? Is that...
Well, I mean, this is part of my point, which is that, you know, I'm not sure. Maybe the question is, can you make that leap? In other words, you know, most of your book focuses on the sort of origins of monotheism, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, you know, and then we say, well, what can we learn from those origins to, you know, talk about relationships among religions nowadays? Mm-hmm. The problem, of course, is that leapfrogs about a millennia worth of history, which it's very tough to escape. You know, as you said, we have the Crusades. You know, we have colonialism, you know, of the Christian kind, across much of the developing world. You know, we have, you know, to use Sam Huntington's phrase, Islam's bloody borders at this point. So I guess I'm concerned whether or not, in other words, can you draw conclusions about whether or not, I think your argument seems to be religions can get along, you know, particularly based on how they originated. I guess my concern as an IR person would be, can they escape the weight of history, which is rather significant? You know, we're talking about a millennia's worth of religious wars.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, as I said, I'm not an expert on kind of the intervening periods.
Right.
Everything I hear about is consistent with my model. I mean, like the Crusades is a classic, say, zero-sum argument over land. And I think the standard scholarly interpretation is the kind of realist one, in a sense, that the motivation really wasn't, if you look at the motivation of the politicians involved, the motivation wasn't fundamentally religious. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what I mostly read about it, right?
Yeah.
And that's the essence of my model, is that the so-called religious conflicts are not about religion at their core. I mean, to give you one contemporary example, one thing I don't like about the tenor of some of the new atheists is their assumption that, A, religion is always bad, B, that it's really determinative. I mean, Richard Dawkins in The God Delusion writes, if it weren't for religion, there would be no Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which I think shows zero understanding of the actual history of the conflict, which began as an essentially secular squabble over land. And so, you know, I would say, first of all, what things I know about the intervening period are more or less consistent with this view. And secondly, to speak to your point of, you know, hasn't something changed in the intervening 1,000 years? Well, I would say, you know, if you look at, you know, this the intellectual, one of the intellectual kind of godfathers of Osama bin Laden is this guy, you know, his name is spelled Qutb.
Syed Qutb, yeah.
Right, he wrote this book, Milestones,
right.
Was killed by Egyptian authorities,
yeah.
But was an intellectual, a big intellectual influence. If you look at Milestones, this is written in, like, I think the 50s and 60s kind of, over an extended period of time, he starts out by complaining that mainstream Islamic interpretation of the doctrine of jihad, which originally was a doctrine designed to justify conquest,
right,
designed to justify the establishment of an empire, his complaint as of the mid-20th century is that the mainstream Muslim interpretation of jihad is that it justifies only defensive wars. Okay? So, as of that point, his interpretation, and he knows more than I know, mm-hmm. of the mainstream doctrine, was that it had mellowed to a point of being something you and I would wish the whole world would adopt. In
right.
other words, you only fight in self-defense, right?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I guess I'd like to hear about specific things that seem really inconsistent with the idea that religious doctrine is ultimately malleable. I mean, it definitely can take some time to adjust. You know, I'm not saying that if we rearrange the facts on the ground in the Middle East right now in ways that made nobody feel threatened and so on, that overnight all manifestations of radical Islam would disappear.
Mm-hmm.
But everything I do know is consistent with the hypothesis that in the long run, religious doctrine is pretty responsive to facts on the ground. I would actually think that this worldview makes sense to you. I guess I've always had the vague idea that realists tend to have a kind of materialist view of the way history works, right?
Oh, they yes, I think that's a safe statement. And to some extent, I'm sort of applying the critical faculties from a slightly non-realist perspective, which asks to what extent. I guess here would be the way I would phrase it. I think you're absolutely right that sometimes, you know, that a lot of the origin of religious ideas or evolution of religious ideas come from materialist foundations, mm-hmm. which is, you know, there are changes in situations on the ground, and that leads either secular or religious leaders to reinterpret their religion in such a way that is obviously more amenable to the situation on the ground. However, there is a question of over time, the religion itself or the ideas itself create some kind of cognitive lock-in that becomes very difficult to escape. Not realist, but there's a whole branch of international relations theory called constructivist scholarship that, you know, is built on notions like ontological security, mm-hmm. which would say that, you might create the ideas, and the ideas are created on materialist foundation, but after a certain point, what matters is the ideas themselves, not their initial origins. And as a result, it becomes that much more difficult to change those ideas, or requires a truly radical disjuncture between the ideas and their situation on the ground. And unfortunately, that radical disjuncture is often accompanied by violence, or it requires violence to recognize, oh, gee, our ideas are not working. Does that make sense, Bob?
I do think that, yes, religion, the mood of a religion, although even if I believe and argue that it's ultimately responsive to the facts on the ground, it acquires a momentum.
Yeah.
Now, whether you want to say that during that period of momentum it's the ideas that are in charge as opposed to the material world,
right,
is kind of a separate question, because you could equally well look at it at the material level and say, okay, so suppose you agree that American foreign policy, among other things, including internal conditions in Muslim societies and so on, has created this radical strand of Islam. Now, the materialist explanation of any momentum it may have is things like, so as a result, there are these guys running madrasas, and their social status is tied to those madrasas. They're now like locally famous for running a radical madrasa, and it's a bunch, and they're not going to, if they say, oh, we were wrong about doctrine, then they lose social status. So, I mean, I would actually trace the momentum that the mood of a religion has to material factors, often at a finer grain level. But that's really a metaphysical question almost. I certainly concede the point that there is momentum. And I also, I'm not saying the doctrines and ideas are irrelevant, because when a religion mellows, sometimes a doctrinal adaptation has to take place. And sometimes that involves real creative intellectual work.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And because religions are different in how much reverence they accord the text, and in what ways the text informs the legal structure of the society as well. I don't mean to oversimplify the thing, but I do think that the first step in moderating a religion is to make the people in the religion feel that you are not a threat to their material interests, to their values. And I think in that sense, Obama's on basically the right track. I wrote a piece in the Huffington Post not long ago,
mm-hmm.
Coincidentally on the pub date of my book, arguing that actually, without even trying, he's illustrating the thesis of my book. The jury's out on whether it'll work, but
without reading your book, you're arguing Obama has embraced the argument almost with deity-like powers.
I would say it's more evidence, that he is actually a deity. Yes.
Uh-huh. But can you explain the sort of content of this?
Well, just that. In drawing a line in the sand on the settlements issue, I think he realizes. You want to give the Palestinian people a sense that, ultimately the zero-sum game over land is going to end. There's some hope that it can end.
Yeah.
The process of encroachment on territory is going to end immediately. That's totally consistent with my thesis that you want them to not think of this as a zero-sum game. Although, of course, ultimately, the negotiations over land, there's a lot of zero-sum that's intrinsic in any discussion over land.
Yeah, I mean, that you can't escape that logic.
Right, but you want to give them the sense that ultimately, I mean, of course, the context of this dispute over land is that probably both people are going to continue to suffer if they don't resolve it, so it's non-zero-sum in that sense,
yes.
And you want to give them the sense that an equitable deal is possible.
You want them to get a sense that if they strike a bargain now, it's better than striking a bargain later, because all that happens in the interim period is that both sides suffer.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I think you first of all want to convince them that a win-win outcome is possible. I think people on both sides are actually skeptical of that over there, for various reasons. And I think more kind of vaguely, I think Obama, in trying to convince the Muslim world, in quotes broadly, that we respect them, is another way of trying to get them out of a zero-sum mentality. I mean, when someone doesn't respect you, that in kind of evolutionary psychology terms, that's sending a signal that they want to lower your social status.
Right.
You know, that's the way the mind reads that. And social status is a zero-sum game.
Right, this is about recognition.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think broadly speaking, you know, he seems to believe that if you change factors like this, religious, you know, they will empower the elements of religious moderation. And I just think he's right. And although most of my book is ancient history, a large part of the point is to illustrate that he's right.
So you would say that Obama's Cairo speech, for example, is certainly emblematic of the approach you would like him to see take on, you know, religion in the Middle East?
Yeah, broadly.
Okay. I mean, I'm curious, you know, obviously as we're speaking right now, I think about an hour ago, the Supreme Leader of Iran, the Ayatollah Khamenei, gave a religious address where he, if I read this correctly in the BBC, did not back down in the slightest on the election outcome, and basically said, look, we're going to let things go through the Guardian Council, but these protest things have got to stop. Just an open-ended question. I mean, do you think your book can provide any insights into sort of the struggle that's going on in Iran right now?
You know, not very specific ones. I mean, I would say, you know, to the extent that that if you buy the idea that in fact the moderates won the election, okay, and actually we're not clear on that. I think.
No, I think it's a disputed point, but I have to admit, I find increasingly the arguments made by those that says Ahmadinejad did win the election to be increasingly less plausible from a poli-sci perspective. This isn't to say that he doesn't have genuine support, but, you know, John McCain lost the election and still had 40-something percent of the vote. So,
right.
You know, I mean, I think it's you can say that Ahmadinejad still has a viable base of support and say he lost the election, and those two are not, you know, contradictory arguments.
Yeah, now look, I would like to believe that he lost it, because that's more consistent with the thesis of my book in the sense that, you know, Obama earlier, but before the Cairo speech, launched this, you know, we respect Iranians initiative, right, with this videotape.
Right.
And if that actually succeeded in empowering moderates and taking power away from the radicals, that would be consistent with my view. So I hope it's true. I just haven't been following it closely enough, and you probably have been following it closer than I have.
There's been a couple of interesting arguments, on Free Tehran, talking about the urban-rural divide.
Right.
Nate Silver at 538 has done a couple of posts looking at the election data. You know, it suggests first there's not necessarily a hidden rural base of support for Ahmadinejad. And it, furthermore, if you take a look at the way the election was called, it just seems very dodgy. But go ahead. Sorry.
I'm interested in anything you have to say on that, and I'm interested in your take on the thing more broadly. I mean, what are you thinking is going to happen? Are you thinking he's going to be able to shut down the protest?
I have to admit, I guess almost millenarian or apocalyptic on this at this point, which is the demonstrations themselves have changed the equation. If we were talking about a week or 2 weeks ago, I think the perspective of the Obama administration would have been that, you know, and actually Obama said this on Tuesday, that really on regard to the questions like the nuclear issue, it didn't matter who won, Mousavi or Ahmadinejad. the problem we're in now is that the protests themselves have not just called Ahmadinejad into, you know, his power into question. It's gone after Khamenei, which is the moment Khamenei said, you know, these elections were divine. I mean, I believe he said divine, you know, result that Ahmadinejad won. And yet you've had 5-6 days of protests suggesting, no, that's not the case. That's the reason why I think this is interesting, because it's not what's going on isn't just about Ahmadinejad, because in some sense he's less important. It's Khamenei that's important. And the fact that his supreme authority is being challenged by the brute fact of hundreds of thousands of people marching in the streets day after day means that I don't think there's any elegant way out of this situation. I don't think there's any way Khamenei can compromise with protesters, because to do so challenges his supreme authority, as I see it. And even if he makes an offer to compromise now, it's purely tactical, and, you know, I think supporters of Mousavi recognize that if they compromise now, they're going to be, you know, cracked down later. So, unfortunately, I think there's only one of two ways this ends. Either it ends with a massive crackdown, which will be bloody, or it ends with elements that actually have power, like the Iranian military, deciding, you know what, we're not going to tolerate this anymore. It's time for Khamenei to go as well.
Wow.
I recognize there are multiple power centers, and, you know, partly what's going on is whether or not Rafsanjani can overthrow or, you know, slightly push Khamenei aside. But I just don't see a kind of compact. I mean, another possible way out would be some kind of compact where enough, you know, power centers in Iran decide, okay, you know what, Ahmadinejad and Khamenei have gone too far. Let's nudge them out and let's do it in a, you know, relatively peaceful, bloodless coup d'etat. I think the problem is that the Revolutionary Guards are way too invested in those two figures, and they're not going to go down without a fight. So,
but I've also heard that there's some division of loyalty within the military. Have you?
Well, when I say the military, I'm talking about the non-Revolutionary Guards military.
Right.
I'm talking about sort of the straight military. And here, you know, again, I won't claim, you know, vast amounts of expertise, but I mean, the Revolutionary Guards are the ones who have actually profited tremendously from the current sort of leadership in Iran. I'm not sure how well the sort of mainstream military.
So there could be a division between the Revolutionary Guards and the mainstream military
and other military forces. That I think that's my point. And that, you know. I mean, then the situation sort of comes like Romania, you know, in 89, where the Securitate, you know, backed Ceausescu and the rest of the Romanian military decided, no, we're not going to deal with this anymore. And, you know, maybe if you're lucky, you only have a few days of violence. But I just don't see how else this ends. I don't think the protests are going to go away on their own accord. I think Mousavi is a much smarter, more ruthless politician than someone like Khatami. So he's not going to back down quietly, and he knows that he can't back down. If he backs down now, you know, he's through. So I just don't see how this ends.
That's not cheering. Yeah, I don't. I mean, especially after this morning, I've only heard kind of secondhand reports. But if indeed, you know, there's no compromise at all coming from the top, I have no. I'm not optimistic. And what do you think, as a realist, well, two questions. Do you think the U.S. should grit its teeth and do business with whoever winds up on top? And B, even if you believe that, do you think Joseph Biden spoke out a little too soon in assuring the world of that?
Which Biden statement are we talking about?
The early Biden statement, when things were very, very early and fluid, he said, we'll do business, you know.
Yeah. I it's easy to say now that he spoke up too early because he didn't know the protests were going to sustain themselves. I think the one misstatement that's been made was when Obama said, I think on Tuesday, that it really wouldn't make a difference at this point if Mousavi or Ahmadinejad won. As I said, I think he was right. If he had said that a week earlier, he would have been correct. And there are ways in which, oddly enough, a Mousavi victory would have been, I mean, I think the neocons actually had a point here, which is the ways in which a Mousavi victory would have actually complicated the negotiations, because Mousavi would have seemed like a very reasonable public face. He wouldn't have had any control over the nuclear program anyway,
right. But
it would have made things trickier in terms of negotiating. This is where I break somewhat with the realists. I mean, my colleague Steve Walt at Foreign Policy sort of basically argues, look, no matter how this goes down, I think you're going to have to negotiate with the with the leadership in terms of the nuclear program. And on a grand scheme, I think he's right. The problem is how it goes down is going to profoundly impact that, which is if it goes down in a Tiananmen-style way, well, you know, then negotiations are going to be just politically, pragmatically impossible for at least, you know, 6 months to a year. It's going to be tremendously unpopular. And furthermore, it's going to be incredibly difficult because if you think that the clerical leadership had, you know, a sort of Manichaean worldview before this, you know, it's going to be even more paranoid if they manage to come out on top. And in some ways, you know, you've seen for the last couple of years now a lot of, you know, both Ahmadinejad and others sort of talk about their fears of a velvet revolution in Iran. You know, if you remember about 2 or 3 years ago, the Iranians arrested a whole series of Wilson Center people, you know, accusing them of trying to foment a velvet revolution. And, of course, the irony was they were right, I suspect. And that is partially what's going on right now, you know, or at least an attempt at a velvet revolution. So I think it's going to be incredibly difficult to negotiate with the Iranians if a crackdown takes place and the same people that are in power now continue to be in power. If you actually see a regime change, and by regime change I mean that both Khamenei and Ahmadinejad go away, then I think, you know, there's a space that opens for negotiations, which is you're not going to get the Iranians to give up their nuclear program. But what you can potentially do is agree to some sort of arrangement whereby it really does become a civilian nuclear program. You know, you allow for the creation of a fuel cycle, you know, within Iran, but under international monitors, for example. And that might actually accommodate both Iranian pride and, you know, Western fears. Because if you take a look, you know, one of the comments about Iranians is that, you know, they're very proud of their nuclear program, and that's undeniably true. But the polls I've also seen suggest they also don't actually want to have nuclear weapons. Or at least the broad majority of Iranians don't. And in a revolutionary moment, you know, when you have a new leadership, you might actually be able to take advantage of that fact and cut an accord. But the problem is that we just don't know how this is going to end at this point. And how this plays out is going to dramatically affect what foreign relations are between the Obama administration and the Iranians. I have a blog post up now. I mean, one of the other things is that it's not just the United States that has sort of been wrong-footed by this to some extent. If there's actually a real change in the regime, the Russians are going to be royally screwed. Because, among other things, they were the ones who hosted Ahmadinejad right after the election. And it was clear that although they started to try Medvedev tried to distance himself a little bit from Ahmadinejad, there were enough Russian statements right after the election that I'm sure the Russians are going to be looked at a little bit suspiciously by any sort of new leadership.
Do you agree with Obama and with kind of my thesis that trying to convince the Iranians that we're not a threat, that we respect them, would tend to, and maybe has tended to, have a moderating effect on the tenor of religion?
I think the problem with that is that in some ways you can make two arguments. First of all, I don't want to exaggerate what Obama's effect has been on the election in Iran.
Yeah, I don't either, really, so but it's kind of an in-principle question.
Right, okay. You can argue that it's had contradictory effects, that on the one hand, clearly the attempt by Obama to reach out, you know, to ordinary Iranians to indicate the respect for them, you know, potentially did bolster support for Mousavi on the argument when Mousavi was making that, yes, we need to have stronger relations with the United States, or at least more open relations with the United States, that Ahmadinejad has embarrassed us in front of the world. On the other hand, you can also argue that the opening is what made Khamenei so nervous in the first place, which is sometimes religious leaders, you know, bolster their power by identifying who the other is, by identifying who the enemy is.
Well, right. And that's actually what I would say in place of what you said at first. It's the way I would see the Obama effect working is to make it harder for the religious fundamentalists to demonize this particular enemy, namely us, which is what amps up religious fervor when they can do that successfully.
Except that it made them, by making them more insecure, it also forced them to take more radical steps, which was, you know, calling the election so early and Khamenei saying it was a divine, you know, outcome.
Yeah, that is, though, a perverse kind of indication of the policy, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's my point.
We successfully made the leaders threatened by doing something that indeed will naturally tend to undermine support for them.
Right, but my point is that if you're trying, I mean, this is a fundamentally realist question, which is if you're trying to negotiate over nuclear weapons with the Iranian leadership, how do you do that? Do you do that by making them feel less secure or more secure?
Uh-huh.
Paradoxically, if Obama has reached out in this way and made the Iranian leadership feel less secure, then as a result, they've had to crack down. Now, does that mean that what Obama did was wrong? Not necessarily, because we don't know how this is going to play out right now.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you got to take the bad with the good here in terms of Obama's policy, which is he undeniably, you know, you can argue that you know, he perhaps gave succor to, I'm not sure I pronounced that correctly, you know, to the opposition. But at the same time, he made the leadership nervous enough so that they've taken a series of steps that, you know, indicated they're willing to crack down. That
yeah.
Actually their preferences are to have a well-defined enemy rather than take the hand that Obama is reaching out to.
Yeah, although at the same time he's made it harder for them to characterize this as the enemy. So I don't know. I mean, I would say if your net conclusion is that he shouldn't have done it, I would say that would make you a hyper-realist, not just a realist.
No, but my point is that there are. My point is this is a high-risk game we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess here's my question back to you. I mean, you know, Mr. Progressive Realist, which is let's assume this plays out in such a way that even though the attempt to make the United States the enemy, you know, doesn't necessarily have that much – doesn't resonate that much with a lot of Iranians, in the end, the leadership deciding they're going to stay in power no matter what decides to engage in a vicious crackdown. That's their only option, and they manage to keep the security apparatus, which is quite formidable in Iran, relatively cohesive, and they stay in power.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do then?
I think in the end, when the dust is settled, you probably have to do business with them as a practical matter. I think you avoid saying things that are supportive of them in the meanwhile, and even reiterate your own values, which are inconsistent with what they're doing.
But I'm not sure there's any business to be done with a regime like that.
It depends. If there's no business to be done, then you don't do business, but I don't know, what do you do? You probably wouldn't recommend invading them.
No, I wouldn't. I mean, but I guess my point is that I'm not, I understand why you still try to negotiate with them, but they're not going to give up their nuclear program. They're just not. Particularly in a post-crackdown situation. I don't see anything the United States can offer them that would convince them, you know what, we do feel safe now. Let's, you know, relinquish this program.
Yeah.
And so I guess my point is that this is not to say that, you know, you don't go through the process, and I mean genuinely go through the process of trying to, you know, negotiate with them, but you're going to have a contingency plan for what happens if those negotiations fail, because they're going to fail.
Yeah, well, and I mean, the nuclear thing is not the only thing on the table. There's no negotiating to be done,
yeah.
Then ultimately you don't do that. I'm still not in favor of invading them.
No, I didn't say that.
I'm not generally a big fan of sanctions, but so we'd probably wind up in roughly the same place.
Well, you might wind up. I mean, one of the things, you know, again, is that you might wind up with a tougher sanctions regime, particularly during a post-crackdown period, because you know all the regular all the usual suspects will be a little more accommodating on that. I think one other, you know, I would say this, the other aspect in which Obama has played this, I mean, I think it's a, there are ways in which you could argue he's potentially played it a little too cool, but if you really want a sort of grander realpolitik perspective, one of the things that I think Obama has done relatively smartly is try to couch the language on Iran in such a way that it doesn't freak out Russia and China.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as much as Senator, you know, John McCain has been saying, you know, Obama should be on the side of the Iranian people, my understanding is the way Obama has constantly talked about this is that, you know, this is up to the Iranians themselves and their own procedures, and it's all a question of domestic, you know, politics within Iran. And by framing it in that way, it makes it more comfortable, particularly for, you know, China and Russia, you know, who are very sensitive on these sovereignty issues,
mm-hmm.
In such a way that he doesn't make it sound like a sort of transnational, you know, mass movement in favor of democracy, and therefore it does seem less threatening to those great powers.
Yeah. But, you know, on the question of whether the regime is so hard-line that there's nothing to be said to them in the aftermath, it seems one possibility, you know, we have no idea how this is going to play out. But if the moderates can remain to some extent a looming threat to the hardliners who emerge in the aftermath, right?
Yeah.
And it may be that, you know, the modern technological environment will leave them in that position. I don't know. And that's another interesting question, is what we've learned about what it is that it's easy for the government to shut down.
Yeah.
Technically, and what's not. I'm still not sure how resistant Twitter is to this.
I don't think anyone's going to be sure for a little while.
But the government has not yet succeeded in... Twitter has remained alive, right?
Yeah.
The government, they can shut down the cell phones, they can shut down text messaging.
Well, also, what's interesting, I don't know if you saw this morning, but apparently both Google and Facebook had launched new products specifically geared for the Iranians, which is Google, I think, now has a Google Translate feature from Farsi to English,
mm-hmm.
and Facebook is now saying you can use Facebook even if you don't... even in a non-English context.
Uh-huh.
And I think both companies basically, you know, made this announcement specifically geared towards the Iranians. But
yeah.
We honestly don't. I mean, it's still way too early to evaluate the effects this is going to have on the Iranians. I think there's two ways in which the government could potentially deal with this. The first is to try to crack down on it. The second thing, which I think is also happening, is they're trying to sort of deke out the opposition by creating sort of fake proxies for Mousavi supporters as a way to sort of, you know, gin up, saying either, you know, making them sound more radical than they are, or telling them to go someplace where they shouldn't go, things like that.
Well, and aren't they committing violence that they are attributing to the Mousavi supporters?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, the other problem is that I think there are ways in which the reportage on this exaggerates the extent to which both sides have control over their supporters.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear to me that Mousavi actually, you know, he doesn't. A lot of these protests were more spontaneous, even though Mousavi wasn't involved in them.
Yeah.
And similarly, on the security side of things, while the Basij has been, you know, has certainly engaged in violent acts, we don't know if those are violent acts because of, you know, I can't believe I'm about to say this, a few rogue agents, or is it been a clear, you know, policy of intimidation, intended policy of intimidation.
But one interesting thing to me is some degree of international transparency is just proving very difficult for the government to evade, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, if you think back to 50 years ago, something like this happened in Russia or China, I don't think we'd have nearly the degree of knowledge of what was going on.
Well, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets are going to get out no matter what.
Yeah, but I mean, we've got footage, you know.
Yeah. No. There's no question there's more visceral stuff. Although, I have to wonder, I mean, most of the footage has been concentrated in Tehran, right? I mean, one of the big questions about this is, to what extent does this kind of social protest extend beyond Tehran? And this is a big question. If it's happening in Shiraz, in Ishra, I'm going to mangle all the cities. But if it's happening beyond Tehran,
mm-hmm.
that indicates the extent to which this is really an existential threat to the regime. But I haven't seen a lot of footage on those parts. I mean, there it's been much more rumor and speculation.
That's true.
Than footage. So, again, I agree with you. I mean, obviously, it's much easier to get this sort of stuff out now than it would have been 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure how much – I guess it's a question of magnitude. How much easier is it to get this stuff out? And furthermore, to what extent does this fuel even more the paranoia of the regime? You know, the fact is that as realpolitik as Obama has been, the U.S. was still called in by – or the Swiss were called in by the Iranians to protest the interference by the United States. Which is, you know, from a U.S. perspective is kind of laughable, but from their perspective makes a fair amount of sense.
It makes a fair amount of sense just to as a way to further demonize us in
yeah.
the, you know. But these two things are kind of related. I mean, you've said, on the one hand, his charm offensive makes them feel so threatened
yeah.
that it may have a perverse effect,
yeah.
and similarly, this technology inflicts so much transparency on the regime that it may have perverse effects
right.
by making them feel threatened. In both cases, I think you've got to go with it. You know?
Oh yeah, no.
And I mean that to get back to this question of whether making people feel less threatened works, I just think, you know, you're right. There is going to be this perverse effect that anything you do that is going to succeed in undermining a horrible authoritarian regime is going to make them feel threatened and lead to some sort of backlash. But I don't think that should keep you from doing anything whatsoever to make them feel threatened. And I think...
my point is that this is the gamble we're talking about right now.
Yeah.
Which is that, you know, for all the talk about Obama being, you know, pragmatic and realpolitik, a lot of stuff that he's actually done has been somewhat, you know, as we've agreed, subversive to the Iranian regime. The problem is we don't know how that the effect of that sort of the extent of that subversive effect. Will it lead to a regime transition, or will it lead to a regime that becomes so scared of their own population that they wind up sort of pursuing a North Korea-like, kind of policy after this?
Yeah, but it's very it's funny how subtly these two effects are intertwined, because what you're saying is the non-realist, what you're calling the non-realist part of his approach is kind of the charm offensive, because that makes the regime feel threatened, and yet ostensibly it's part and parcel of his realist determination to do business with the nation of Iran regardless, right? I mean, that's kind of why the right didn't like that videotape, right? Because,
right.
You see my point.
Yeah, I guess I would say this. This is where, you know, occasionally realism has a bit of a problem, because realists tend to assume that states are cohesive, unitary actors.
Right.
And the problem you've got in Iran is that it's not a cohesive, unitary actor at this point. The first thing the regime cares about is its survival. But the greatest threat to its survival at this point is no longer the United States. It's their own population. And that's why this is sort of having very odd effects and unanticipated effects.
But that's also why, now that I reflect on it, I think that a videotape was kind of masterful, because ostensibly it was an overture to the government as well as the people. What's for the government to complain about? And yet it was subtly subversive in intending to moderate the religious extremism that the government lives off of.
No, this is...
The man is a genius. I think maybe he has read my book.
No, you can certainly argue that what Obama has successfully done is thrown sort of, you know, fundamentalists across the board, potentially, off kilter. But particularly, you know, in the Middle East, Al-Qaeda has dealt very badly with the Obama, you know, with the effect of Obama's election. And you can argue that what Obama always, you know, is successfully able to do is put the lie to fundamentalist interpretations of his election and his foreign policy. You know, so in that sense, he has wrong-footed a lot of people in the region, and wrong-footed people that we don't necessarily see as allies. The question becomes, what is the effect of that wrong-footing? And that we still don't know the answer to that, unfortunately.
No, I think I think he's on the right track, and you never know what the perverse short-term implications will be. But I think he's doing something whose intrinsic effect is to moderate the religion and disempower religious extremists. And yes, that will lead the extremists to do desperate things in an attempt to gin up support. But that's intrinsic in any moderation campaign almost. So
let me put it this way. I really hope you're right. Here's my fear, which is that, you know, a religious extremist religious movement backed by the coercive power of the state, if they crack down right now, you can argue that then the religious part of this is bankrupt, but they're still going to be in power, and my hunch is they're going to be in power for at least a generation.
So would you have advised him not to do the not to do the charm offensive?
No, I would have advised him to do it, because I don't think anyone could have anticipated.
Right.
You know, no one expects the Spanish Inquisition. No one expected. In some ways, you can argue this all boils down to the notion that Khamenei miscalculated by declaring Ahmadinejad the winner, and whatever sort of shenanigans took place to make Ahmadinejad not just the winner, but the winner by a 2-to-1 margin, which just doesn't pass the smell test. The moment they did that, and there was a reaction on the scale of what we've seen, that's where we are today. You can argue that the problem that the Obama administration faces is that it was actually Khamenei and Ahmadinejad that did not act in a pragmatic, realpolitik fashion. That they didn't realize that the way to go was just let the election take place the way it was. Even if Mousavi gets elected, he was actually, you know, probably wouldn't have affected the nuclear negotiations all that much, and the clerical, you know, the clerics would have maintained their power.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say that And furthermore, as you said, you know, again, to go back to the caveat we opened with, we don't know if Obama's charm offensive was not the sole contribution to these kinds of outcomes. I mean, he probably didn't hurt. We just don't know how much he helped. But this is a very tricky, high-stakes poker game, and no one knows who's holding what.
Okay, so we're close to an hour. Do you want to close with a prediction of where we'll be, Friday the 26th?
I don't, because, I mean, I'm not, you know, this is one of those things where, as I said, I think it's one of two possible outcomes. I guess my fear is that the next week there's going to be some bloodshed. And it's not going to be this level of seven people killed. It's going to be more than that. And I really, really hope I'm wrong, and I'm far from clairvoyant on this stuff. What about you? What's your prediction?
I don't purport to really have a clue. I'm very impressed with how kind of disciplined the opposition has been, whether through centralized control or through some sort of, you know, like smart mob thing. And you'd like to think that that could keep tons of people from getting killed, but I just don't have a clue. I just don't have a clue.
All right. So. We'll call this the Clueless Godless Blogging Heads.
Now, it wasn't godless.
No, that's true. Clueless Godful Blogging Heads.
Right.
But it was a pleasure, Bob, and good luck with the book. It's been wonderful to read, actually.
Well, thanks, and I'll see you soon, online or off.
All right. Take care.
Okay.